Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're Talking History on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the birth of modern belief, the history of Irish publishing. We'll also explore a wonderful new exhibition on Kilmainham Jail, discover the truth behind the life and legend of Buck Whaley, and to end the show, we'll find out about how one extraordinary society changed modern science. Last week, we looked at the life and legacy of Alexis de Tocqueville and discovered how he changed how we think about democracy. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or go directly to iTunes. But first, the birth of modern belief. A new book explores how religious belief lost its uncontested status in the West. It traces the history of belief in the Christian West from the Middle Ages to the Enlightenment, revealing for the first time how a distinctively modern category of belief came into being. Ethan Shagan focuses not on what people believed, which is the normal concern of Reformation history, but on the more fundamental question of what people took belief to be. The book is called The Birth of Modern Belief, Faith and Judgment from the Middle Ages to the Enlightenment. It's published in hardback by Princeton University Press and cost £27 sterling. That's about €30. The author is Ethan H. Shagan. And Ethan, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Tell us what this book is about. It's a book about the history of belief. What does that mean?
Well, it means that what we take belief to be, that notion that belief is our own judgment or opinion and that we have sovereignty over what we believe and how we believe, that is a fundamentally new condition, and that in the European past, in the Christian past, belief has meant fundamentally different things.
And it gives us a very different take on the Protestant Reformation, because it's upending that traditional idea that the Reformation created this modern new world.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I think there's a sort of a myth out there. It's a myth held often by Protestants, but by non-Protestants as well, that the Reformation involves a sort of liberation, that it involves a new freedom of belief. And if you take seriously that belief itself has changed over time, then the new kind of freedom of belief in the Reformation simply doesn't mean what you think it means. That is to say, for the reformers, for Martin Luther, for John Calvin, belief was an extremely difficult condition. Most people, according to Luther, and indeed all Catholics, according to Luther, didn't believe at all. They didn't have religious belief. They didn't even believe in God. So when Luther suggested that people needed some version of freedom of belief, what he meant was belief for himself. He meant freedom for the people who agreed with him. Others, those who did disagreed with him, those who didn't have saving faith, didn't have belief at all. They only had some version of sinful opinion and therefore needed to be controlled rather than to be liberated. It's almost as if while the Catholic Church was expert at controlling what people believed, the Protestant churches became expert at controlling unbelievers.
And in a way, this changes fundamentally how we understand the place of religion in the modern world.
Well, that's right. The idea that we can have freedom of belief turns out to be dependent upon belief itself being a concept that naturally can admit freedom. If you take belief to be a pure connection between God and human beings, or if you take belief to be a kind of obedience, or if you take belief to be a whole series of things that it was earlier in the European past, then a modern sort of sympathy between religion and the broader society becomes impossible. In modern society, the way you believe religious ideas and the way you might believe scientific ideas or believe social ideas can be considered commensurate. They can be considered comparable to one another. So, for instance, Thomas Jefferson, in his Act for Religious Freedom in the state of Virginia, said that your opinions in religion should have no more bearing on your civil status than your opinions in physics or in geometry. That whole concept is based on the idea that we have opinions in religion, and that our opinions in religion are in some sense comparable to our opinions in the sciences, in other spheres. And that's the novelty here. The novelty is that religious belief loses its unique primacy, its unique status in the West, and becomes, at least to some degree, the same kind of thing as the way you believe in, say, global warming, or the way you believe in ghosts, or all the other things that the pollster might ask you when he calls you on the phone, what you do or don't believe. The notion that that's simply one more choice, that that's simply one more opinion, is what this book is studying. That is a slow process by which religion lost its unique primacy in the West and became just another sort of thing that people think.
I'm very interested in the subtitle of the book and how it goes from the Middle Ages to the Enlightenment. Why did you decide to take that as your period for study?
Well, this was originally a book about the Reformation. This is a book that began when I discovered Martin Luther saying that Catholics don't believe in God. And I thought, what a remarkable claim that is. How could that be? I must be misunderstanding this. And then I went and I thought, well, who else? So I went to John Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion, and I saw in the modern English translation, he says that anyone who follows their own affections denies that there is a God. I thought, wow, where does this stuff come from? So I had to then go back to the Middle Ages to discover what these reformers were responding to. What I discovered in the Middle Ages is that there was a very wide array of different views of what belief might be. So, for instance, you could believe with the church, and if you claimed that you believed with the church, then you could be taken to believe anything the church said was true, even if you didn't even know what it was. Or for another version, infants could be said to believe in the same sense that people who are asleep have eyesight. It's a faculty that they possess, even if they're not currently using it. So there are all these different medieval conceptions of what it meant to believe. And it's the Reformation, it's the crisis of the Reformation, that takes all of those different medieval possibilities and says, no, belief is hard. Belief is not something that simply everyone can have. The different confessional communities of the Reformation era circled the wagons around belief, claiming that belief was a special condition which only they had and which only their most devout people had. And then in the Enlightenment, that condition is relaxed again, but not by going back to a medieval condition, but rather through a kind of liberation of belief, in which belief becomes something like opinion, something that's generated through evidence, something that's generated by the individual through their own engagement with the world. It's John Locke writing in the 1680s who first proposes that religious belief is simply your judgment in response to evidence, the same way you would respond to evidence in any other realm. So that's the kind of trajectory of the book, from a kind of judgment which is faith to a judgment which might admit faith, rather than being faith in itself.
Okay, well, Ethan, congratulations on the book. It's called The Birth of Modern Belief, Faith and Judgment from the Middle Ages to the Enlightenment. It's published in hardback by Princeton University Press and costs about €30. The author is Ethan H. Shagan. And Ethan, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Egan. In a new book, publisher and author Tony Farmer places the development of Irish publishing in its social and economic context, exploring how the mechanics of the industry, alongside the changing structure of Irish bookselling, have underpinned developments in the trade. The book is called The History of Irish Book Publishing. It's published in hardback by The History Press, costs about €30. The author, Tony Farmer, who sadly passed away, and the book was completed by Conor Costick, who joins me tonight. Conor, you're very welcome to the show.
Always a pleasure.
It is very sad that Tony didn't live to see the completion of the book, but you were very good to step in and complete it. How did you get involved with the project?
I was the editor for it. So I was working with the manuscript and looking forward to it being published, and for Tony to be enjoying the rewards of his lifetime passion for the history of Irish publishing. and unfortunately died with it. The story told up to about 2000, so most of it, but I just had to manage that last period, and it is a fascinating period that the crash and the consequences for the publishing here were quite significant. So that was my role, to bring it through to final production.
It's an extraordinary story, and I love things like, for example, the impact of copyright legislation on Irish publishing, because it had huge implications.
I learned a lot in the process of this, and you know, it would be a story that one could tell of a small nation battling for elbow room against the big nation and always finding an uphill struggle, except that the early copyright law favoured Irish publishers enormously, because basically there was no copyright in Ireland until the Act of Union. So if you were a publisher here, you could see what was selling in London and just pirate it, you know. So quite shocking, but quite lucrative.
A new book, Robinson Crusoe or something, is published in London, big bestseller. You can just publish your own edition of it here in Ireland.
Yep, and without paying anybody anything. So for a while, the story isn't one of David and Goliath. It becomes that, though, after the Act of Union. It totally changes, the landscape completely changes. But also even right up to today, the copyright, I mean, it's so volatile, publishing. The landscape could be transformed by, for example, a copyright exemption that allowed universities and schools to use whatever they wanted could wreck the models of the education publishers, which is what happened in Canada when they experimented with that.
What I also was fascinated by was the different trends in Irish bookselling. So, for example, in book publishing. So, for example, you could have a boom period where Irish publishers are doing brilliantly and there's a great demand. But then suddenly there could just as quickly be a period of recession, and then they go bankrupt. And it was fairly precarious, and you see the ups and downs of the profession over the centuries.
Yeah. So Tony made the point that it was an industry that was seen as recession-proof, the thought being people will always read even when times are bad. But he demonstrates that certainly after the 1960s, the boom-slump cycle massively affects the publishing industry. And he also makes the point that you wouldn't really, you'd have to have a passion for it. It's not like a business where you're just in it for the money. Obviously, that, you know, publishers do want to make money, but it's so precarious, and your success, it usually depends on just one or two titles, and then you've got this other list that barely managed to make a profit at all.
When we think of Irish publishing, we always think of censorship, and that features in the book as well. How big of a challenge was that?
Massive, massive. And it really didn't come home to me until I was working with the manuscript. Those censorship years from the 1940s to the 1960s were a disaster for publishing, for book production in Ireland. They were grim. I mean, up to 700 titles published, and titles we all love and enjoy today, just completely blocked. And Edna O'Brien, for example, who's one city, one book at the moment. But, you know, loads of names that really were household names today couldn't get published in Ireland and were blocked from being published in Ireland. It was a very grim period, except, funnily enough, in the Irish language, where it probably had its heyday, 40s and 50s.
You said that it wasn't a David and Goliath story in the 18th century, but as time went on, it became one. And you definitely see that Irish publishers were facing, I suppose, the condescension of British publishers, but then they also had to face the challenges of multinationals and new technologies. And it, I think, became much more difficult for them in that changing environment.
It's a very difficult environment, because the UK publishers had access to the Irish market. The Irish publishers, for a while actually, and after the Second World War, weren't allowed in the British market. But even when they were allowed in, had no practical way of getting the booksellers to take the books. And were, like you say, condescension kept Irish publishing out. So it wasn't a level of playing field. Publishers did very well, I think, the generation from the 70s. But now they have a new challenge, because the big multinationals are here and publishing in Ireland. But it's not a simple, straightforward, small Irish good guys, big multinational bad guys. It's far more complex than that, especially because, for example, Penguin Ireland has an Irish editor, Irish publisher, Irish staff who know the Irish culture. So it's a more nuanced picture.
Well, it is a fascinating read, and I think it is a tribute to the passion and the energy of Tony Farmer, and he made a huge contribution himself, and I think this book is an important part of his legacy, and I think congratulations to you, Conor, for helping to bring the book to completion. The book is called The History of Irish Book Publishing by Tony Farmer, completed thanks to the help of Conor Costick, who joins me tonight, published by the History Press, costs about €30. And Conor, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Living Inside is an exhibition that tells the stories of six people whose experiences speak to how much institutional change has occurred in Ireland in the last 50 years. It's an art exhibition highlighting health as a driving force behind Irish prison reform. And I'm delighted to welcome to the studio three people who have been centrally involved in it. Professor Catherine Cox of the School of History at UCD, who has been a principal investigator on a project funded by the Wellcome Trust that has, I suppose, brought together a lot of the research for this. Dr. Oisín Wall, who is a research postdoctoral fellow whose research has been informing the case studies used in this. And Brian Crowley, curator of collections at Kilmainham Jail. Well, you're all very welcome.
Thank you.
Catherine, can I begin with you maybe about the idea for this exhibition? Where did it come from?
Well, the idea for the exhibition comes out of a broader project, which is, as you said, funded by the Wellcome Trust and is looking at prisons, English and Irish prisons, and exploring them as potential sites for health or ill health from 1850 up to more contemporary time. So that's the research, I guess, the overall research project. And there are a lot of different themes and strands of research within that. And part of that, and one of those themes, looks at the issue of prisoners and prison reform and protest, basically. So that's the bigger project, I guess, and that's Oisín Wall's specific research theme. And then when we were thinking about ways of actually communicating our research beyond academia, we were thinking about, you know, innovative ways of actually exploring how to get our information to the audience. One of those ideas that we came up with was an exhibition. We decided an exhibition would be a good idea because of the work of Derek Spears. The exhibition at Kilmainham has or uses a lot of Derek Spears' photographs. If you don't know who Derek Spears is, he's a fantastic photojournalist who captured, I guess, every significant social movement in Ireland since about the late 1970s to contemporary time. And his work is very interesting because he focuses on individuals. If you look at those photographs that we've used in the exhibition, they're very sort of concerned with individual expressions and individual experiences. And we felt that very much spoke directly to actually the type and the approach that Oisín himself was taking to his research. So I guess pulling all those elements together is what we had in mind.
So Oisín, let's talk about your research and these six people's stories and lives. I suppose, first of all, why did you choose them? And then how difficult was it to piece together those stories?
We started with the idea of six people's stories because the activists in the 1970s who were kind of the first real activists in the 20th century to start agitating for prison reform in Ireland, they started using individual stories as a way of arguing for reform. So they kind of picked out particular people's mental health problems or ill health and used that to illustrate reasons that we need to change the system. And we picked the six stories as a cross-section of the things that have changed the prison system in the 1970s and 80s. We picked reformers both inside and outside prison, people like Margaret Guy, who was involved with kind of every major social movement in the 60s and 70s, and Danny Redmond, who led a prisoners' union in the early 70s. And then we wanted to look at how mental health and physical health shaped the prison system. So we picked Carl Crawley, who was a man with severe mental health issues, who ultimately brought a case against the Irish state to the European Court of Human Rights, claiming that his treatment inside was torture. And then Derek Cummins, who was the first man to die of HIV, of AIDS in Ireland, in the prison system. And then we also wanted to get outside the experience of prisoners. So we were lucky enough to interview a very long-standing prison officer who had been working in the system since the 70s, and he gave us some really interesting insights into what the training of prison officers were like. And then we interviewed Anne Costello, who was has been a kind of a teacher in Mountjoy for a long time and has really shaped how education works in Mountjoy. There's also a sort of practical side to the ways that we chose the people, because, you know, historically prisons have been very secretive institutions, particularly in the 70s and 80s. And so we might want to have a wide range of stories to choose from, but actually it's quite limited. So these were the best six from the ones we managed to get together.
Brian, the exhibition began in Kilmainham Jail in February, and it was so successful it was extended until early June, and now it's moved to DCU. Can you tell me what was the reaction of people to it? How did they respond?
The reaction has been really positive. I've been really impressed at the degree to which people are engaging with the exhibition. After a while working in museums, you can tell the difference between somebody kind of mindlessly looking at something that they're bored by and something that they're really, really engaged with. So I've been really impressed by that. And I suppose for us as well, one of the issues that we have is sometimes there's a kind of a disconnect in people's mind between the historical story that we tell and current events. So people can be very sympathetic often to the prisoners of the 19th century and early 20th century. It doesn't necessarily affect how they look at the system today. But in many ways, the problems that were afflicting the Irish prison service, prison system in the 1970s, were very similar to the 1870s and in some ways the 1770s as well.
That's what struck me, that sometimes exhibitions, historical exhibitions, can be a bit removed from the present day and current concerns. But this has actually, this is great social value, because it's forcing us to think about these issues in the present day.
And to make that connection as well. And I suppose the other positive thing for us is when we talk about prisoners in the 19th century, they're generally their names in prison registers. We know very little about them, who they were, why they were in prison. And what this exhibition gets across is the people who are involved, the people who were the prisoners. And particularly, I think Derek Spears' photographs are so powerful that people really kind of connect with these people's stories as people. And they're much more, I suppose, vivid than the presentation of sometimes of 19th century prisoners, where they end up, I suppose, ending up often being a statistic rather than actual people in terms of how they are perceived.
And Catherine, this is part of a much bigger project.
Yeah, this is part of a much bigger project that looks at prisons that looks at prisons from the foundation of what we would conceive of as the modern prison system, which is roughly from the middle of the 19th century. As you know, Patrick, as a historian, there's a huge amount of work has been completed on looking at other institutions in Irish history, looking at workhouses, lunatic asylums or psychiatric hospitals. But very little work has looked at the prison system as a space people may end up. And of course, you know, prisoners are people who get sick as well as, you know, people who have committed crimes. And this is where our research started, is to explore to what extent, like what happened when somebody became ill in the prison in the 1830s or in the 1870s. In particular, we're quite interested in looking at what happened to people who, you know, experienced mental distress or when they were in prison, or the prison environment itself prompted mental disorders. And how does a system that really is not set up to deal with people that are challenging, I guess, and potentially disruptive to a system that's based on discipline, how does a system actually manage that? And how indeed does a country manage those individuals when, you know, there's huge stress on resources outside the prison system as well as in the prison system? So yes, it's part of a much bigger project.
And a project funded by the Wellcome Trust.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So what will be the next step?
Well, the next step, it depends on which bit we're talking about. We have other types of public-facing activities. Over the years, we did a... You might help me out here, Oisin, if my memory slips, but we did a art installation also in Kilmainham Jail called The Trial. We did a more public event called Health Inside, which basically was a series of posters and billboards across Dublin in the area around Mountjoyne to try and prompt people to think about some of these issues. And more recently, we did a very successful play with Broken Talkers, the Dublin-based theatre group, called The Examination, that ran in the Project Arts Centre and in the Access Theatre out in Ballymun. And we're delighted to say that play is now going to be travel to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in from the 12th to 26th of August. So we're very excited by that as well.
Very good. And if people want to catch this exhibition, Living Inside, it's now moved to DCU.
Yes, that's right. We're moving it. We've moved it to DCU. It's in quite a different space there, as you can imagine. It's in quite a modern space. It's the new, very, very beautiful library that they've opened up there. So the way it's presented has been changed a little bit, all the key elements are still there. The images from Derek Spears, the text and stories that Oisin referred to, and also our oral histories, which we included. We have three oral histories included in the exhibition, and we've also been able to reproduce them. So it's free of charge as well, both in Kilmainham and in DCU.
Okay, well, my congratulations to everyone involved. A brilliant project. My thanks to Brian Crowley, Curator of Collections at Kilmainham Jail, Dr. Oisin Wall and Professor Catherine Cox. We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Thomas Buck Whaley was one of the greatest adventurers in Irish history. In 1788, he made an extraordinary 10-month journey from Dublin to Jerusalem for a wager of £15,000, equivalent to several million today. And a new book tells the full story of his remarkable life and adventures for the first time. The book is called Buck Whaley, Ireland's Greatest Adventurer. It's published in paperback by Merriam and costs €16.95. The author is David Ryan. And David, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Hello, Patrick. How are things?
Well, talk to us about Buck Whaley, because some people of a certain age may remember the nightclub that was in Leeson Street named after him, but probably didn't know who it was named after when they were there. So tell us, who was Buck Whaley?
Sure. Yeah, the nightclub, I think, is the point of reference for most people today. But Thomas Buck Whaley, born in Dublin in 1765, was a very wealthy, privileged Anglo-Irish gentleman, I suppose is probably the best way to sum it up. His father, Richard Chappell Whaley, had inherited quite a few landed estates and made a bit of money from property speculation, this kind of thing. And Thomas inherited this when his older brother died at an early age. Thomas became the oldest surviving son, and he came into an estate worth between about £50,000 and £60,000 a year in their money, and an annual income from the rentals from the estate of around £7,000. So just to do, as you know only too well, Patrick, there's no exact system for converting from old money to new money, but that could be is certainly in the millions in today's money in terms of his annual income, and his estate would be in the tens of millions.
And he doesn't seem to be particularly good with that money. Is that where the name Buck came from, that he was a young buck who liked the high life?
Yeah, Buck was quite a common nickname for a young gentleman at that time. You had Buck English, who was a well-known duelist, I believe, and Buck Sheehy, people like that. If you were kind of a bit of a lad, a man about town, maybe willing to fight the odd duel and get into the odd scrape, you could be a buck. And hence Thomas Whaley was certainly all of those things, and he got the name Buck Whaley as a result, and kind of survives today. You know, my bucko and that kind of terminology, and maybe getting a little bit archaic today. But
so tell us about the infamous Jerusalem wager. Then it was a lot of money, and I suppose the stories that that he came back with of avoiding pirate attacks and bandits and the plagues and everything, like it made him this figure of huge interest. It made him a celebrity.
It did make him a celebrity, yeah. And you know, trawling through the newspapers of the era, there are quite a few reports, not only on his return, but also up to and during his expedition. In the lead up to his expedition, there was quite a bit of interest, not just in Irish newspapers, but also in some of the London press, you know, that this young Anglo-Irish gentleman was going to undertake a journey to Jerusalem for a wager of £15,000. And it was speculated on the press that he wouldn't manage to pull this off, because by this time he already had a strong track record of misadventure and basically gambling debts and disasters. And he was thought to be too volatile, too flaky a kind of character to have any chance of getting to Jerusalem and back in 1788, 1789,
which at the time was a much more complicated and lengthy and difficult undertaking than what we would undertake today, which would be a simple plane flight. But back then it involved many days at sea, many difficult and tedious days on overland journeys. But when he did return, as you say, yes, he became a celebrity and he was the focus of considerable interest in the popular press in Britain and Ireland.
And were there any terms and conditions for the wager? Did he have to do it within a certain period or did he have to do anything when he was over in Jerusalem?
Yes, the terms and conditions were reported in the newspapers and it varies. The reports vary. Whaley himself, I think in his memoirs, says that he had a year in order to complete the trip. But in the newspapers, it varied anything from a year to 18 months to 2 years, or that he had a year to get there, but that there was no limit on the time with which he had remaining to return. So it's not clear. I think it was probably a year. From the most accounts have it that it was about a year that he had within which to do this. And he didn't need to do anything in particular when he got there, other than, I suppose, to bring back some sort of proof that he had been there. And he duly did obtain this proof from the convent, from the superior of the convent of St. Saviour's, or the convent of the Holy Land in Jerusalem. And he also obtained a second a corroborating document from the guardian of the Franciscan convent in Nazareth. So he had these two proofs to bring back with him to show that he'd completed it.
He won the bet, but he doesn't seem to have learned or got any sense from his journeys, because he went on to lose even more money gambling in the years ahead. Talk to me about some of his other adventures. Is it true that he tried to rescue King Louis XVI from the guillotine?
Yes, you're correct. He didn't seem to have. He doesn't seem to have learned the lessons of his his wayward youth, if you will. But when he returned from Jerusalem, he was still only 23 years old. And I think that's what we've got to remember. He wouldn't be the first young man to have his head turned by a lot of celebrity and a lot of attention and a lot of notoriety at that time. And yes, everything spiraled downwards into gambling and debt and all sorts of disasters and more scrapes in the years that followed. He had a very disastrous loss at cards in St. James's Street in London in 1791, £26,000, and that forced him to flee to the continent. He was very nearly arrested and would have ended up in a debtor's prison, only for he managed to get on a boat at Dover and managed to get himself off to France. And he spent some time in abject poverty in the French capital, managed to return incognito to Ireland and surreptitiously raise some money by selling an estate in early 1792, and then returned to the continent and retrieved his fortunes by successfully running a faro bank in Paris, which brought him tens of thousands actually in profit. The first time since his Jerusalem success that anything he had done had turned out to his advantage. He then went off and lived the high life in Switzerland for a period of time after that with some other exiles from Paris, because Paris was getting a bit hot to handle for aristocrats at the time as a result of the excesses of the French Revolution. But he made a fateful decision at the end of 1792 to return to Paris in order to pick up some money that was owed to him from his faro bank, the casino that he had been running in Paris the previous year. He was owed quite a substantial sum, probably in the tens of thousands. But when he returned, he returned to a city that was in very serious turmoil as a result of the proceedings against the king, the one-time King Louis XVI. Whaley would have been an ardent royalist as a member of the Anglo-Irish upper classes, and would have been very sympathetic to the king's plight. And he says a few days before the king was executed, when the sentence of death was pronounced against him by the tribunal of the National Convention, he saw the ministers of the tribunal mount the carriage pale and trembling, like so many, you know, like so many truants, or like so many culprits who realise what had they just done. Scenes, I'm sure, very akin to the scenes leading up to the execution of Charles the First in 1649, which incidentally his own ancestor had been one of the signatories of Charles the First's death warrant. So it was very ironic that he then was very sympathetic to Louis the XVI's plight. He was very sympathetic to Louis XVI's plight, and he decided that he would make an effort to rescue him from the guillotine. He was staying quite close to the Place de la Révolution, which is now at the Place de la Concorde. And he decided that he could perhaps, by some work of magic or artistry, spirit the king away from the guillotine. But when he approached the Place de la Révolution on the day of execution, the 21st of January 1793, he realised that he hadn't a hope. It was surrounded by rows of blue-coated soldiers, defended by cannon placed at the entrances. And when he took one look at the scaffold and the rows of soldiers ready to crush any disturbance that surrounded it, he realised that he didn't have a hope, and he fled from the scene and ended up in a coffee house. But very interestingly, a scene then occurred in the coffee house, which he recorded on the spot.
And it's interesting, he died in the year 1800 and a young man, but having squandered almost £500,000. And he said that all the money, all of the adventures, it didn't give him a single hour's true happiness.
True, he said, I think his words were, without purchasing or acquiring a single moment's happiness or contentment or something to that effect. I suppose the old adage is money can't buy happiness, isn't it? And it seems to have proved to be true in Whaley's case. However, having said that, I think when you look at all the sources that are available, it seems that he did maybe find some kind of, I won't say contentment, but he did seem to learn maybe a little bit how to play the system a little bit better by the end of his life. In his early life, and certainly in his 20s, he'd been very much the dupe of various sharpers and swindlers who'd gotten him drunk and built him out of thousands at the gaming tables. But by the end of his life, he had some very significant successes, not only gambling. He gambled that St. Swithin's Day in Ireland would rain. It would rain for 40 days following St. Swithin's Day in 1799, and Ireland being Ireland approved to do that. He won a very significant sum there, 7,000. But also he, during the Act of Union, as you'll know well, Patrick, he played the system very cunningly there. Initially, he opposed the union. Was bribed with £4,000 to support the Act of Union in circa 1800, and then he was bribed a second time by the support of the Union to oppose it, and he did so. So he did very well out of that by following both sides.
Okay, well, it's an extraordinary story. Book Whaley, Ireland's Greatest Adventurer. It's published in paperback by Merriam and costs €16.95. The author, David Ryan. And David, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Now, to end the show tonight, we're going to look at how one extraordinary society shaped modern science. Cambridge is now world famous as a centre of science, but it wasn't always so. Before the 19th century, the sciences were of little importance in the University of Cambridge. But all that began to change in 1819, when a society was founded to keep alive the spirit of inquiry. The book is called The Spirit of Inquiry, How One Extraordinary Society Shaped Modern Science. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £25 sterling, so about €28. The author is Susanna Gibson. And Susanna, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
It's an extraordinary look at a society that I wasn't aware of its impact on the world of science. Can you tell us about the Cambridge Philosophical Society and how it was founded?
That's right, Patrick. So it was founded 200 years ago this year, which is why the book was published this year. It was founded in Cambridge, as you said. And at that time, Cambridge, although it was a big and very old university, it didn't really teach very much science. And the Cambridge Philosophical Society was set up by two young fellows at Cambridge. One was called Adam Sedgwick. He was a geologist. And one was called John Stevens Henslow, and he's most famous for being a tutor to Charles Darwin. And the two of them got very interested in studying geology and the life sciences, and they were making these new discoveries, and they realized they didn't have anywhere to share their new knowledge. They could give science lectures in Cambridge, but there was no guarantee the undergrad would turn up, which is kind of the same today, actually, in some ways. But they decided that they wanted to set up a forum for scientists in Cambridge to meet and share their new discoveries, and a place where they could publish their discoveries, meet other scientists, and try and create some new knowledge. So it was really quite a new thing for Cambridge in 1819 when it was set up.
And it had some hugely significant results, including being the first ones to publish Darwin's Beagle Letters, in other words, his first scientific publication.
That's right, yes. So Darwin had studied at Cambridge. He wasn't able to do a science degree because they didn't exist yet. So he had studied the normal kind of diet of mathematics, classics and theology, and he was sort of intending to become a country vicar. And then he got offered a place to travel on the Beagle when he was just 22. And he travelled out on the Beagle and he again saw these incredible things in South America, and he was having all sorts of thoughts about geology and botany and zoology. And the person he was writing all of those thoughts down for was John Stevens Henslow, who I mentioned earlier, one of the founders of the society. And Henslow was so excited by Darwin's discoveries and all of the letters that he was getting from South America that he decided he would read them aloud at a meeting of the society. And it was just something incredibly new. If you're in Cambridge, which I don't know if you know Cambridge, it's very flat. It's quite cold and quite pedestrian in some ways. And Henslow brought these letters along from South America, and he was talking about the Andes, he was talking about earthquakes, he was talking about volcanoes, he was talking about the native inhabitants that Darwin was meeting for the first time, and all kinds of incredible flora and fauna. And he, when he read these letters aloud in Cambridge, people were just fascinated by them, by this whole other world that they had never seen, had never imagined. And there was so much demand for these letters that Henslow ended up publishing them in a little booklet. And that became Charles Darwin's first ever scientific publication. And I think what's really interesting is that Darwin didn't know about this until about 6 months afterwards, because he was in the South Pacific when it came out. And of course, it would take months and months for letters to come from Cambridge down to the South Pacific and back up again. So he was in South Africa when he found out about this book, and he was a little concerned because he had no idea what it said, how his words had been edited, anything like that. But it was a very well-received book, and Darwin was delighted in the end to have a publication, and that was thanks to the Philosophical Society.
You also have a very interesting look at how women struggled to be taken seriously as scientists, and it was a difficult fight for them to win.
Absolutely, yes. So women in Cambridge, women were not awarded degrees until 1948, so after World War II, which is shocking, really. So in Dublin, women could get degrees in Trinity from 1904 and in the NUI universities from 1908. But in Cambridge, it was a couple of decades behind in that respect. But the society did let women come along and give talks at their meetings. It didn't grant them full membership until the 1920s. So that's about 20 years before they could get degrees. They could join the Philosophical Society. But yeah, for women in Cambridge, it was a place where they could come and give talks, where a lot of other places were closed to them. And it's really fascinating. In Cambridge, there was a women-only laboratory, and that there was quite a strong link between that laboratory and the Philosophical Society. And a lot of the women who worked there and made incredible discoveries could come along and share them at the Society and publish them in the Society's journals. So it was, in that sense, it was welcoming for women. But as I say, they couldn't actually become full fellows until the 1920s, which is quite late, really.
You know, shocking when you consider how long, as you say, it took then to award degrees as well, that ahead in some areas and then very much behind in some others. Some great stories about the support the society gave to up-and-coming scientists in the 20th century, including to Lawrence Bragg, who published a paper on X-ray diffraction when he was only 22.
That's right. So Lawrence Bragg was a young physicist, and he was, as you say, he was just 22 when he gave his first ever, I think it was his first ever scientific paper, and it was presented to the Cambridge Philosophical Society. And it was about this technique called X-ray diffraction, where you take a beam of X-rays, you shine it onto a crystal, and they come out the other side in a very regular pattern. It's called a diffraction pattern. And in the case of shining X-rays onto these particular crystals, it comes out as a series of regular dots. And he was able to figure out from the position of those dots on the photographic plate what the positions of the atoms within the crystal were. And that's the basics for X-ray diffraction, which is the technique that was used to decode the structure of DNA and all sorts of things like insulin. And it's been one of the most incredibly useful scientific techniques of the 20th century. But it was just this 22-year-old who did this paper, and all of the diagrams in this little paper he presented are hand-drawn, so it's really lovely, and you can kind of see that he was quite young and inexperienced, but he's got these incredible, powerful ideas that went on to change all of 20th century physics. And he's the kind of person who I think might not have been given a platform in the kind of bigger, more formal societies like the London societies. They wouldn't let a 22-year-old in with kind of some hand-drawn diagrams. But in Cambridge, he was welcomed into the Philosophical Society and managed to produce a piece of research that really impressed his much more senior peers. And in fact, after he published it, it was his father who became his biggest supporter. His father had always had some doubts about the wave theory of X-rays versus the particle theory of X-rays. But when he saw that paper by his son, he was convinced, and the two of them started collaborating, and they were jointly awarded a Nobel Prize for it, which is quite nice.
Finally, is the society still going strong today in the 21st century?
It absolutely is. So yeah, it's got loads of events on for its 200th anniversary this year. The biggest thing it does, actually, there's a couple of big things it does. It publishes two world-class journals. They have a maths journal and a biology journal. But for me, the most exciting thing they do is they fund lots of young researchers. So they're continuing that tradition where they, you know, they gave Darwin a platform when he was quite young, gave Lawrence Bragg a platform when he was young and unknown. And now they fund more junior researchers. They get 3 years of funding to do blue skies research. So anything they like, any topic, as long as it's interesting, and they can go in whatever direction they like. And they've produced some incredible results. So in the book, I talk a little bit about the evolution, early evolution of animals, and some work they're doing on that at the minute, trying to push back the boundaries and figure out if animal evolution started earlier than some geologists think it did. And they've come up with some really incredible results.
Okay, well, Susanna, congratulations on the book, The Spirit of Inquiry, How One Extraordinary Society Shaped Modern Science. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press, costs £25 sterling, so about €28. The author is Susanna Gibson. And Susanna, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me, Patrick.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, we'll be bringing you the story of the East India Company, and we'll be debating the making of an empire. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.